ABC Radio Australia.
Well, the Pacific, it continues to find itself at the centre of a geopolitical battle for influence. And a recent 60 Minutes programme claimed that a well-known Chinese businessman living in Fiji was a key operator for the Chinese Communist Party and a senior member of a transnational criminal syndicate. But over the weekend, the Chinese embassy in Fiji put out a video refuting those claims. So more on this story. We are joined by senior fellow for the Australian Strategic Policy Institute and visiting fellow for Canterbury University, Jose Sousa Santos. With that, I say bon dia, and thank you, Jose, for joining us this morning.
Bon dia, Aggie.
Yeah,
thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate your time this morning. A lot happened, and I'm sure you probably saw that 60 Minutes video. But yeah, what were your thoughts about that from the Chinese embassy having to refute those claims made in that 60 Minutes Australian program?
The program itself was very interesting, and it was quite good to actually see that intelligence from Australia, the Australian government and its agencies was shared with the Fijian government, and left the Fijian government to be able to follow its own procedures. But this is the one thing that we have to remember, is that this is the strongest piece of information that has been put out through this piece is what has been put out by the Australian government. A lot of what was put out as well tends to be contentious, and when we're talking about issues such as state condoned or facilitated operations, you need to ensure that you have the hard data to push it.
Mm. And I know there is a lot to unpack on the story itself, but let's get to the response from the China embassy. I mean, they say the 60 Minutes story was based on lies and speculation. What's your thought on that, though?
Well, I think that you would expect that from the Chinese government, and it's definitely not surprising that the Chinese embassy in Fiji denounced the claims. However, if I need to add that at a meeting of the Five Eyes Law Enforcement Group in 2022, Australian Federal Commissioner Rhys Kershaw stated the long shadow of organised crime is fueling state aggression and is fueling an increase in serious crimes. So there is a long-standing nexus between state actors and organised crime. So what was put out by the Fijian embassy isn't exactly true to what we've already seen. And what's been put out by regional law enforcement agencies.
What I thought was quite sort of unusual was, the step they took for the Chinese government to actually make a video. Usually they'd issue a bland statement from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Did you find that unusual or not?
I did, and it did seem to me that it was very much targeting a Pacific audience. And this shows just how much the CCP and its its foreign affairs department understands the way that the Pacific works and the way the Pacific mind works and the culture. It structured a message for the Pacific, not for other audiences. So if you're going to cause confusion, if you're going to create a message which is going to try to counter hard proof, you would counter with that type of response.
Yeah, once you sort of really looked into it, the 60 Minutes program didn't really have evidence of its claims against the Chinese businessman. I mean, do you think they were justified to at least to name him and raise those allegations against him?
Well, definitely. And I think one of the important things here is that the evidence put forward in the 60 Minutes show indicates that Zhao has been determined by the Australian law enforcement since at least 2021 to be a senior member of a transnational criminal syndicate that has been active in the region for decades, and likely has good access to corrupt officials, and that Zhao has been designated by the Australian Criminal Intelligence Commission, who added Zhao to its registry of Australian priority organisation targets in mid-2023, suggesting that Zhao is seen to be a significant threat to Australia. So again, it's the information and the intelligence that's been made open by the Australian intelligence organisations, which normally would not be, which gives credence to these allegations.
If you've just tuned in, speaking to Senior Fellow Australian Strategic Policy Institute, Jose Sousa sent us about the 60 Minutes program claiming that a well-known Chinese businessman living in Fiji was a key operator for the Chinese Communist Party and a senior member of a transnational criminal syndicate. Jose, I want to get to this, and I'm sure you're aware of who the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime people are. They've launched this series of reports mapping regional trends in organized criminality. And they confirmed that China's increased presence brings with it criminal organizations. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
The dual nature of China's involvement in the Pacific is not new. And I can recall the discussions in Canberra in 2013 comparing how China utilized criminal actors and networks in other and other non-state actors in Southeast Asia, where I previously worked. And the likelihood it would mirror this behavior in tactics in the Pacific. Over the past decades, we've seen this manifest in the region in a number of ways. It is helpful to distinguish between state-condoned and state-sponsored or state-sanctioned transnational crime activities or operations. For example, state-sponsored or state-sanctioned activities are those that are carried out with active support of the foreign state. And that could be foreign some misinformation activities that could be hacking cyber crimes and when you're talking about state condoned, and I think this is what we're looking at with Zhao, state condoned illicit activities is when for example transnational criminal syndicates which are not part of the state mechanism but as long as their goals and targets coincide with the foreign states, or in this case China's goals and targets in that country, are given carte blanche and preferential treatment to be able to operate and in some ways to destabilize and to create pressure or even to narco corrupt elements within the traditional power structures and governments.
Okay, well, when I was watching the piece, Fiji's Prime Minister, Sitiveni Rambuka, he admitted that China could be involved in organised crime. So this leads me to my question, would have it been in his best interest to not have maybe gone ahead with this controversial policing agreement with China then?
It would be a big call, being that China is a big donor for Fiji, and then actually for most of Pacific Island countries, so I think this is something that that's been looked at very carefully by Sitiveni Rambuka and his government, and I do believe that one of the things that will come out of this, we've already seen that the Fijian police force will not have a Chinese liaison within it. That's already been taken out of the. Of the agreement, but I do believe that we will see a redrafting of this agreement, which will be more to Fiji's control. This is about national security as well, so that we don't see the same issues where China, working extrajudicially, directly, government to government, and bringing in Chinese police onto Fijian sovereign soil and arresting Chinese citizens outside of the Chinese the Fijian judicial system.
All right, well, let's switch to the fact that Pacific seems like an easy target, for the transshipment of drugs, again, vulnerable for meth, heroin and cocaine to come into the Pacific. I'm wondering, is there at least maybe a Pacific-led model to combat transnational crime?
Well, currently, the Pacific law enforcement architecture, where you have the Pacific Island Chiefs of Police, the Pacific Transnational Crime Network, the Pacific Transnational Coordination Center, and also as part of the security architecture, we have the Oceanic Customs Organization and others is tasked with addressing this threat, and it is at the moment. Adapting, it has been found lacking in some ways, but it is adapting quickly. It has realized that there is a threat which it wasn't aware of, and that is the, and has developed and has become endemic to the region. Not just the trafficking of the drugs through the region, which has happened for decades, but we're now starting to see an overflow of these drugs to Pacific communities. We're now starting to see not just high level facilitators such as Zhao and other associates throughout the region, but also starting to see our own Pacific regional criminal syndicates now operating and facilitating the activities of these larger transnational criminal syndicates, be they Chinese, which of course are the ones which hold more political capital in the region. So I think one of the as the Pacific law enforcement architecture evolves, the very clear message is that it must be, for it to be effective in the region, it must be Pacific-led and partner-supported. And currently, the model is partner-led, Pacific-supported. And I think this is where there is a big chasm in what's being in the operations. What it leads to is the perception, and I think also through the operations and the seizures, that the Pacific is being utilized as a buffer for both Australia and New Zealand to keep the drugs out of Australia and New Zealand, but not actually protecting the Pacific itself from these drugs and these syndicates.
Thank you for that. Jose, as we wrap up, we talk about Chinese aid, right? And I know that the Prime Minister stated he's got to make a bit of a delicate balance of anyone's influence in the Pacific. But when you think about in terms of aftermath of natural disasters, yes, outside aid would be helpful, right? But what else can be done in terms of international influence?
The Pacific sees China as a development partner outside of the security sphere. One of the biggest issues here is where China can become a disruptive, is seen as being involved in disruptive engagement in the Pacific. Is that it does not engage in the region, be it in regards to aid or security through the regional architecture. It attempts to do it bilaterally, and for example, in March 2022. Just as the border started to open post-COVID, and Pacific Island countries their economies were under duress, China very quickly came in and offered a multilateral agreement to the Pacific for security and for economic support. Now, of course, this was rebuffed. Because this would be basically creating a competing architecture to what's already in place. But then what we saw is China doubled down very quickly. It adapted to what had happened and doubled down on its bilateral engagement, Pacific region, Pacific countries. So you do have a country which can behave in a disruptive manner in the region, and that of course means that it needs to be brought into account for that it's not just a positive force in the Pacific.